Michael Kardos grew up on the Jersey Shore, received a degree in music from Princeton University, and played the drums professionally for a number of years before beginning to publish his fiction. He has an MFA in fiction from The Ohio State University and a PhD from the University of Missouri. His work has appeared in the Southern Review, Crazy Horse, Prairie Schooner, Gulf Coast, Blackbird, Pleiades, the Florida Review, and many other magazines. His stories have been cited as distinguished stories in the 2009 and 2010 Best American Short Stories. He lives in Starkville, Mississippi, where he co-directs the creative writing program at Mississippi State University. His first collection of stories, One Last Good Time, comes out this week from Press 53. So of the 10 stories in your forthcoming collection, which one had the longest writing process?
The title story was one that I started writing One Last Good Time my third year of my MFA program. No, my second year of my MFA program. I wrote the first sentence because there was a workshop where somebody turned in a story with a really long first sentence and it made absolutely no sense. And so I decided that I would try to write an incredibly long sentence that actually made sense. And I did, and I liked the sentence. And it seemed like the beginning of a story, and then I never wrote the rest of the story. So then about a year went by, and I wrote the first paragraph, and then the first page, and then the first section, and I realized that there was a body in it, and it was kind of a mystery. And then that's all I could figure out for, like, 3 years. And then about 3 years later, I went back and wrote the next chunk of the story, and then about a year later, I wrote the next chunk, and the whole thing probably took about 5 years start to finish.
So when you wrote the first sentence, you had no idea what came after that first sentence?
No.
So that's good.
Yeah, I had no idea, which is not usually the way I write a story, but that was how that one worked.
Mm-hmm. At what point when you're writing a story do you see the end?
I usually see the end somewhere in the middle, maybe halfway through, except for often I'm wrong, and so I write the ending and the ending is terrible, and then I have to go back and rewrite the ending or rewrite the middle, but I rarely know at the beginning what's going to happen at the end.
Mm-hmm. So what are you working on right now?
I'm writing a bunch of stories, a bunch of new stories, that is hopefully going to in some way be a collection, and then also a novel that I'm finishing up, which is, I guess, kind of a mystery too, and actually it kind of uses an idea from the title story, One Last Good Time, where that's a story about, among other things, a guy who is driving a bus and he hits a dog with a bus and is deciding whether or not to stop the bus or not, and in the moment it takes him to decide whether or not to stop. He's already gone 50 feet and 100 feet, and so this decision's kind of been made for him by not deciding. And so the novel kind of begins this in a similar way, where something potentially tragic happens, but by sort of waffling and not knowing what to do, worse things start to happen.
Do most of your stories take place in the same location, or where's the setting for most of your stories?
So One Last Good Time takes place in New Jersey. They all take place in the same town. It's a made up beach town on the Jersey Shore. And I didn't realize originally that I was writing a collection. I thought I was writing a bunch of stories, and it turns out they all took place in the same town and had characters who were weaving from one to another. So it kind of became very much rooted in the setting. Since then, you know, I've been in Missouri, so I've written some Midwest stories, and I've been in Ohio, so I've written some Ohio stories, and I've been in Mississippi for 4 years, and I just started writing Mississippi stories.
So is your next collection going to be linked in the same kind of way, or in a different kind of way, or in a way you don't know yet?
I don't think the next collection's linked at all. Mm-hmm. I think it's just not. It takes place all over the place. This tonally, it's all over the place. I think it's a darker collection in a way. But I don't think that it's definitely not going to be a linked collection.
If your writing were a farm animal, what would it be?
If my writing were a farm animal, it would obviously be... What's an alpaca? Is that the thing that's
like...
What's the thing that's like half zebra and half... You know what I mean? There's a half zebra, half...
It'd be a half zebra?
It's an animal that's like half zebra and half horse, and it looks all messed up, and I think... I'll have to look that up.
Okay.
It would be that, because it looks like one thing, but it also looks like another thing, and maybe it's just a big mess. But maybe it's okay, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's a farm animal.
Right.
I'll be reading an excerpt from the story, Mr. Barada's Ashes Have the Personality of a Grouchy Old Man. The baby upstairs was crying again while I tried to think up a fairy tale for Larry DeSantis, who bowled lane three every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and who was beginning to feel disrespected because for 3 days I'd come up empty. The crying wouldn't stop for hours and was making me crazy. I screamed back. I got off the Barker recliner that I'd burst a heart vessel haggling for at the Army-Navy, took a hammer from my toolbox, and hurled it again and again at the ceiling until my floor was covered in paint chips. Nothing stopped the baby's wailing. Nothing. I sat down again and bit my thumbnail until the skin ripped and blood formed at the cuticle. More screaming from upstairs. Finally, I licked my thumb and went up there to tell the baby's parents to shut the baby the hell up. It was enough already. A note, written in green crayon, was stuck to their door with packing tape. Dear Gunnaputty, take care of Tyron. We left the door open. He likes applesauce. Dear Gunnaputty, take care of Tyron. We left the door open. He likes applesauce. The note was signed M and C, initials for names that I'd forgotten seconds after hearing them the day I'd moved in 3 years earlier. I stepped into M&C's apartment. No furniture, no rugs, no pictures on the walls. In this way, it looked a lot like my apartment. A baby was in the middle of the den in a little plaid seat, bouncing up and down. When it saw me, it stopped crying. I wandered around the apartment. No toothbrushes or combs in the bathroom, no clothes in the closet, no bed in the bedroom. In the refrigerator, there was applesauce behind the ketchup. I went back into the den and picked up the seat with the baby inside and carried it downstairs with the applesauce and the ketchup into my apartment. I put down the seat with the baby and watched for a while. I watched the baby watching me as if I knew things. I didn't. Here's what I learned, though. You put some applesauce on a spoon, push it into a baby's mouth, baby's going to eat. I fed it and fed it, and when it seemed full, turning its head away from the spoon, I said to Mr. Barada's ashes, I'll be home around 10. You are not leaving me alone with that thing, the ashes said. But I had no choice. I had to leave for work, and so I poured the applesauce into a bowl, put it on the floor next to the baby, and left for the Breakneck Beach Bowling Center, where I mop the bathrooms and unclog balls when they get stuck behind the pins. I've heard that working in a bowling alley is the best job for a poet, because it's mindless and doesn't sap your energy. Maybe so, but I'm no poet. This is my actual job. Mr. Barada had been my ninth grade music teacher. He'd had no family, and although his will had specified cremation, he hadn't taken the instructions any further. When he'd been my teacher, I hadn't liked the man. Not one bit. He cursed a lot and smelled like burnt coffee, and he'd seemed very, very old, with those gray bushy eyebrows and creased eyes, and he'd flirt with the 14-year-old girls and berate us constantly about our lousy intonation, and when we played, he'd slash his baton through the air as if defending himself from an onslaught of invisible birds. I do credit him for teaching me basic musical concepts. That he did. A whole note is 4 fucking beats. A half note is 2 fucking beats. Or he'd say, when you see a fermata, look at Barada. Then he'd grin as if all his years spent on this planet had made him wise and cunning. His funeral had been held next to where I did laundry anyway, and it was between the casket and the row of empty bridge chairs that the funeral director overheard me telling one of his clerical staff that Mr. Barada had been my teacher. Suddenly, he, the funeral director, was all smiles, offering me spring water with lemon. So because I had history with the deceased, besides playing second chair clarinet, I'd been on the car wash committee, and since otherwise his remains would be buried behind the crematorium next to people nobody cared for, I said, okay, I'll take the stupid ashes, though I wasn't going to be suckered into paying for an urn. Mr. Barada wasn't a man to keep in an urn anyway. He had driven a 78 Duster, and even our band uniform was nothing but blue jeans and a used white t-shirt with a logo drawn by some student from years past who'd won the school spirit contest. But in a beautiful urn, the funeral director said, the dead feel respected. I'll be back in an hour, I said. I went next door to get my clothes from the dryer, drove home, and dug around in the drawer of my night table for the Real Catch fishing tackle box. That box, hard plastic, sturdy, with a dependable clasp, had been given to me years before by a Real Catch fishing tackle representative one morning when my dad and I were out on the fishing pier. Long ago, I'd used up all the Real Catch tackle. None of it had ever caught one damn fish. So then, I'd use it to store condoms, bought when I was young and optimistic, but I never caught any women either. The box was cursed, I'd like to think, but more likely it was me. I wasn't any good at landing things. I took out the condoms, which had expired anyway, returned to the funeral home, carrying the real catch box, and in went the ashes, and there you have it. You can't just put somebody's ashes back in your night table, so I set the real catch box on a wooden dresser that had followed me from place to place, and eventually to my apartment here on Talmadge Road, next to the prosthetic supply shop. I kept the dresser in the den, covering a fist-sized hole in the drywall left by an old tenant. One morning, a week into living here on Talmadge Road, I awoke to Mr. Baratta's ashes yelling at me from the other room. Tremolo! Largo! Andante! Pianissimo! I went into the den and looked at the Mai Tai box. The remains of my music teacher said, "What the hell are you doing here?" Mr. Baratta's ashes began giving me advice. Often his advice wasn't any good and bordered on the criminal. Usually I ignored him. But yesterday I'd been fed up already, what with the writer's block and the babies screaming, and so when Mr. Baratta's ashes told me for the millionth time that I was sure to die shivering and alone, I sprang up from my kitchen table so fast it fell over backwards, landing with a thump on the linoleum, and stomped over to the dresser. "I'll scatter you all over the beach," I said to the ashes. "I swear, if that's the only peaceful..." "Comrade," the ashes had said, "how about I scatter you all over the beach?" Becky Hagenston's first collection of stories, A Gram of Mars, won Sarabande Books Mary McCarthy Prize, as well as the Great Lakes Colleges Association New Writers Award. Her stories have appeared in the O. Henry Anthology, The Southern Review, Mid-American Review, The Gettysburg Review, Crazy Horse, and many other journals. She lives in Starkville, Mississippi, where she is an associate professor of English at Mississippi State University. Becky's newest collection of stories is called Strange Weather. It is the winner of the 2009 Spokane Prize for Short Fiction, and it was published in 2010 by Press 53. Some of the stories in Strange Weather are certainly realism, and others are definitely fantastical. And I was wondering at what point in writing a story you decide whether a story is going to take on the fantastical.
I usually know pretty soon, but what I've done before in the past is taking a realistic story that had nothing going on because it was so boring and added something kooky into it.
In the story Anthony, which I believe is the one you're going to be reading, that is obviously a fantastical story. And did you know right from the beginning that you would have a talking person inside a girl's belly?
I didn't know where the... Yes, I guess I knew that there would be a talking thing inside the belly of the little girl, but I didn't know who it would be. So... But I didn't know there was going to be something in there. I just, you know, I had to keep writing to find out what it was going to be.
If you could have one circus skill, what would it be?
I would like to ride a bicycle across a high wire, flip upside down.
Are you the kind of person who would be riding the bicycle across the high wire with a net below or not?
Well, if I'm good at it, then no. No net.
Okay. So you've lived in a bunch of places, Maryland and Arizona and Mississippi and maybe other places. And I was wondering if there is a place that you've lived that has informed this book, Strange Weather, more than the other places.
I think, some of these stories are really, really old that I wrote when I was living in Arizona 15 years ago. but probably Mississippi, because that's a very strange place. So I think some of my more interesting strange stories came from living here.
And does that have to do with the setting of the stories, or just something about the place informing the characters? Or
mostly the place informing the characters, because I don't think there's any actual stories that take place in Mississippi, which is weird. But I wrote most of them here.
Have you written stories that do take place in Mississippi?
Yes. And I've written a couple of those, but somehow they never ended up in the book. Although originally, I think Anthony, which was originally set in Mississippi, and then I change it to Alabama.
Do you find that you have to live in a place a while before you can write a story that takes place in it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've lived here 10 years, so I'm just now writing Mississippi stories and running out of Arizona stories. Mississippi is still Still got stuff going on.
If your writing were a farm animal, what farm animal would it be?
I think it would have to be different farm animals. Like sometimes it's a freshly killed chicken that doesn't know what it's doing. That's pretty much dead, spurting blood, but still has some energy. It's a goat. It's a goat because pretty much everything can go into it, and hopefully something useful comes out, like fertilizer, cheese.
What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on short stories that take place in France and a murder mystery that takes place in 1979 in a roller rink.
For each of so France, I know you were in France recently. Is that mm-hmm. kind of what kicked off the stories?
Yes, because France is also a very strange place. So I'm putting some Mississippi people in France to see what happens.
And the roller rink story takes place in a roller rink?
The roller rink takes
the
place.
Novel.
In Maryland, in the town where I grew up, but fictionalized in 1979, because there's a lot of heartbreak and drama that goes on at the roller rink when you're in high school or middle school. So why not have a murder?
Is there a body at the beginning kind of?
There's a body pretty quick. There's in the second chapter, there's a body. And I just now figured out who did it after writing it for a year.
And how far along are you in that?
320 pages of a first draft. Sometimes the words don't go all the way to the end of the page.
But you know who did it now.
I know who did it. Anthony. The ghost had gotten inside her daughter like a tapeworm and refused to come out. How had it happened? Was it something Cindy ate? Something in the water? The water in Bordentown, Alabama was bad. Everybody knew it. Nia usually bought bottled water at Walmart, but this week she'd been cheap. She'd been lazy. She hadn't wanted to haul all those bottles to the car. And now a ghost inhabited her child and wouldn't be budged. Her husband, Jake, blamed it on Nia. He would never let something like this happen to their child. He would have beat the crap out of that ghost before it could get near his daughter. Nia didn't argue with him. She had been planning to leave him for months. He had a temper, and she was almost positive he was screwing the waitress at Longshot's, the bar where they'd met 7 years ago, and where he spent more and more of his time, sometimes not coming home until 3:30 in the morning. The bar closed at 2, so what the hell was he doing until 3:30? Not that she cared. It's because you don't make her take a bath every day, he said. It's because you feed her macaroni and cheese from a box. That shit is horrible for a kid. How the hell do you know what I feed her? Since when are you around for any meals anyway? Sometimes she argued with him just because she wanted to see how close he would get to hitting her. He'd done it once, and she threatened to take Cindy and leave if he ever did it again. And now when he clenched his fists and got up in her face, she stared right back at him and said, "I dare you," and watched him use every ounce of his strength not to bash her in the nose. She wanted to laugh every time, because she was leaving him anyway. It must have happened on Tuesday night, when, yes, she had forgotten to give Cindy a bath after her dinner of mac and cheese from a box. Nia had been on the computer finishing up her homework for Accounting 101, a ridiculously easy course taught by a man who looked like he was 12. Still, it was hard to keep up when you had a child and a full-time job at Blockbuster. She wanted more for herself, and just when she thought she was getting somewhere, didn't it figure, something like this had to happen. The kindergarten teacher, Miss Missy, had been the one to take Cindy to the nurse's office on Wednesday morning. Miss Missy had seen many things in her life. She'd seen a crop dusting plane fall out of the sky above the cotton fields behind her house. She'd woken up in the middle of the night to see her baby sister in the arms of a skunk ape. Startled by Missy's cries, it had dropped the baby back in the crib and fled out the window. She'd seen the spirit of her lynched grandfather swinging from a tree. So when tiny blonde Cindy Morgan's stomach shouted, "Time to party," in the voice of a young black male, Miss Missy kept her wits. The children were just down for their naps, and Miss Missy was in the process of cleaning up the Nilla wafer crumbs and milk cartons from snack time. She detested Nilla wafers, but the children loved them. Those and Fig Newtons. Her own childhood in Tuscaloosa had been filled with chitlins, which stunk halfway down the street, and pork barbecue. She and her sister munched happily on fried pig snouts, snoots her mama called them, after school, watching the Munsters and Gilligan's Island until their mother came home from work. "Time to party," said Cindy Morgan's belly, and the other children turned on their mats and yawned, and Cindy sat up and said, in her own baby voice, "Miss Missy, I feel funny." Miss Missy walked briskly across the room, knelt, and felt Cindy's forehead. "I ain't sick, I'm dead," said the voice from Cindy's stomach. Or maybe it was more the solar plexus. It was hard to be sure. Nurse would know. Nurse felt dread when she saw Miss Missy marching Cindy Morgan into her office. She had noticed the girl earlier that month being dropped off 20 minutes late in a rusty orange El Camino by a woman in a too short skirt and too high heels. Mothers like this were usually bad news. They usually had boyfriends with tattoos and motorcycles, boyfriends who didn't like little children, or liked them too much. "Please, no bruises," Nurse prayed silently, and looked Miss Missy in the eye, as if daring her to say what Nurse least wanted to hear. "Cindy here is having stomach difficulties," said Miss Missy. She put her hands on Cindy's shoulders and said, "Sweetheart, Nurse will take care of you, okay?" "Okay," said Cindy Morgan, and then Miss Missy spun on a heel. Nurse admired Miss Missy's ability to wear heels and was gone. Nurse leaned down and looked into Cindy's pale blue eyes. "Does your tummy hurt?" she asked, smiling, relieved that her worst fears had not come to pass. 2 weeks ago, she had lifted up Timmy Maxwell's Pooh Bear shirt to discover cigarette burns around his nipples. A woman from social services had arrived to lead a sobbing Timmy out to a big white car. Nurse hadn't seen him since. She led Cindy into the examination room and helped the girl up onto the paper-covered table. "Can you tell me where it hurts?" "I feel like dancing," said the voice of a young black man. Then he laughed, a joyful sound that made Nurse almost laugh too. Cindy frowned. "He wants to dance," she said, "but I don't." "Well now, let's just take a look." Nurse lifted up Cindy's pink Care Bear shirt and placed her stethoscope on her white stomach. "It's cold," Cindy said, and then giggled. "Breathe deeply," said Nurse. "That's a good girl. Will you lie down for me, sweetheart?" Cindy lay her head back on the paper pillow and closed her eyes. Nurse touched around her belly button very gently, trying to locate the source of the strange male voice. She had never encountered anything like this before, had never read about it in nursing school or on any of the nursing blogs she looked at every evening while she ate a lean cuisine in front of her computer. "Hello," said Nurse. "Is anybody there?" "I'm here," said the young male voice. "I'm here and I'm ready to party. Hell yeah." He laughed again, and Nurse couldn't help smiling. Then he said gently, "You're a damn good nurse." A nurse felt herself blushing and had to turn away and clear her throat.
Becky, thank you so much for reading.
Thank you, Mike. See you back in Mississippi.